Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Well, folks, we're back, and we're going to dive straight into putting all obligatories aside. I understand that there's a, you know, there's news being made. You know, the world isn't going to get any better. Covering how the framers defined the Constitution. See, let's go ahead and bring Paul into this immediately. So, Paul, welcome back, folks. We're diving into this because GR loves to be right. And there is so much evidence within what these men are saying that they're providing, even in an oblique way, like, you know, when they talk about how the people are to choose their president, in an oblique way, they actually support the concept that we are to choose our electors who then choose our president, not the state legislature. So, I mean, there's all sorts of things that just jump out to me when I read these things that actually clarifies and clearly supports everything I've been telling you. And so, you know, it kind of, you know, it makes me look good. So forgive me. It's not about just being right. It's about getting everything right so that we can do this right. Because if we do it right, then we can actually make America great once and for all, not make it great, you know, again. We want to make it great once and for all. And so that is what we need to do. And so welcome back, Paul. And we basically are in this long oration. This is June 6th.
Hey, thanks.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, I was just saying thanks. Glad to be back. Where do you want to start? Are we picking up with the notes?
Yes.
No, with encroachments? No. We did encroachments.
We did encroachments. So now you're going to cover exclusive. We're going to go into exclusive legislation. And so.
All right, here we go.
Go ahead.
He next objects to the exclusive legislation over the district where the seat of government may be fixed. Would be submit that the representatives of this state should carry on their deliberations under control of any other member of the union? If any state had the power of legislation over the place where Congress should fix the general government, this would impair the dignity and hazard the safety of Congress. If the safety of the union were under the control of any particular state, would not foreign corruption probably prevail in such a state to induce it to exert its controlling influence over the members of the general government? Gentlemen cannot have forgotten the disgraceful insult which Congress received some years ago, when we also reflect that the previous session of particular states is necessary before Congress can legislate exclusively anywhere. We must, instead of being alarmed at this part, heartily approve of it. This leads me to questions. Okay? It makes sense that the general government should have its own space. But what is the disgraceful insult which Congress received some years ago? What is he referring to?
So they were ran out of one location where the Continental Congress was basically ran out. I mean, they were insulted by the people that literally drove them out of that, where they were meeting and where they were residing at that point in time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember what that was?
I don't, but I remember covering it a few years back, and it was like this, that it was just like this huge national insult that, you know, the people of that area said, we don't want you here. And so this is why they wanted to have a sole place. But if you listen to my show yesterday, we have outgrown the need for, because of technology and other things, we can actually bend both time and space to actually have people in different locations and in different time zones be able to meet and actually work together through the issues that they need to work through without having to be in their own little sovereign state. See, the reason why they wanted exclusive legislation to have over the district, because the district one needed to be autonomous, because they didn't want that government to be able to be harassed or controlled in any way by the host state to where they were residing. But if they actually are doing this virtually, they're not residing in any state but their own. So in other words, there's not one state that can harass them. It would be their own people harassing them.
Well, that obviously, that makes sense. It would, they'd be in their own states. But what typically impresses me is when they made a decision, it's because they've had an experience doing this. They didn't just come out of this out of the air.
Right.
I mean, they literally had the experience of being kicked out of the state, and they didn't want that to happen again.
Right. Absolutely. Point taken. Point taken.
That was interesting. Okay.
All right.
So let me go on to exclusive legislation. But the honorable member sees great danger in the provision concerning the militia. This I conceive to be an additional security to our liberty. Without diminishing the power of the states in any considerable degree, it appears to me so highly expedient that I should imagine it would have found advocates even in the warmest friends of the present system. The authority of training the militia and appointing the officers is reserved to the states. Congress ought to have the power to establish a uniform discipline throughout the states and to provide for the execution of the laws, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. These are the only cases wherein they can interfere with the militia, and the obvious necessity of their having power over them in these cases must convince any reflecting mind. Without uniformity of discipline, military bodies would be incapable of action. Without a general controlling power to call forth the strength of the Union to repel invasions, the country might be overrun and conquered by foreign enemies. Without such a power to suppress insurrections, our liberties might be destroyed by domestic faction and domestic tyranny be established. G.R. It is so apparent that the Congress every day, you know, there isn't a day that goes by and a day that has passed since the last presidential election which Congress hasn't had the authority given in the Constitution to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Do they not read the Constitution?
No,
or do
they don't.
They simply, you hear me? Or do they simply
They don't read it. They don't care. See, they believe that, and they're sold on this political power of the dance. In other words, they don't have to follow the law. They have the latitude to figure out how they want to best control the circumstances and give them the outcome that they want instead of actually upholding the law. And you would think that the Republicans would be on board with this too, but actually, over time, Republicans have been basically wooed by corporations saying, we want you to allow these people to come in so that we can have cheap labor.
So what's... Now, here's a question. Since you bring that up and getting to the root of a problem, why do these corporations want cheap labor? Now, I'm trying to get somewhere with this question.
Well, because it's pretty simple. See, the more they save, the more profits they make. Right?
Okay.
So if a company is solely about maximizing its profits, which basically by the current model of the legal parameters of a publicly traded company, in other words, the CEO and the governing board over a corporation's responsibility is to obtain a greater value for their shareholders. In other words, to bring profits in. Now, instead of, you know, because the social justice, because lots of people on both sides of the aisle, you know, think that, you know, corporations have this kind of social responsibility. I mean, the people on the conservative side would say, yeah, there's this moral obligation where it would be basically, you know, abhorred by the progressives. Oh, no, we don't want morality. We want social justice. And so, you know, both sides, you know, kind of talk about this corporate governance of, you know, not being so profit-based, but being more, you know, righteous on one side, and on the other side, more, you know, secular, godless, you know, giving advantages to those whom they want to have advantages. In other words, so go ahead, keep going.
So here's what comes to mind. Isn't the federal government increasing the cost of corporations doing business with all of its regulation and its social agenda that's pushing on these companies? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
In other words, would it be less expensive for corporations to hire Americans if the federal government wasn't forcing these agendas down their throats?
Well, okay, so back to this whole thing about illegals or invaders. Okay. So if you got to remember that the federal government cannot make any regulations at all, period, regarding labor or regarding any of this. And see, so this is how it creates this, you know, how government can create a self-licking ice cream cone, because as they start regulating, then they can start pitting corporations over, you know, these types of issues to say, well, we want that because you're creating these regulations that force us down this path. Because who was the big champion of promoting unions? Well, unions, actually, this collectivism, this collective thought, actually permeated and penetrated into our government to where, you know, Calvin Coolidge was a huge collectivist regarding labor. He was a champion for the constitutional amendment in 1926 to amend the Constitution to allow the federal government to control child labor. Okay. He was a big advocate for unions. And so if government itself became the advocate for collectivizing labor, well, what is collectivized labor? It actually forces corporations to bring the cost of wages up for everybody equally instead of those who deserved the merit. So you see my point. So as government starts getting involved, they create another problem that then they can manage another problem and another problem. And next thing you know, you're in this webbing of government regulations and crap that is forcing us down these paths of more and more control under government.
Right.
So yes, you're absolutely right. The government is the culprit here. Because right. government right. has no authority. Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was silent. I thought we went into a break. So hang on a minute. Okay. All right. So. Okay.
My only point, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, so that's why I said if you had an additional thought, my only point is government is constrained by the Constitution. They have no roles, responsibilities, or powers over any corporation or regulating any corporation. Their regulation of commerce is among the states, not within them.
Sure.
Okay.
All right. So the next section, various means whereby nations lost their liberties.
Yes.
The honorable member then told us that there was no instance of power once transferred being voluntarily renounced. Not to produce European examples, which may probably be done before the rising of this Constitution, have we not seen already in 7 states, and probably in an 8th state, legislatures surrendering some of the most important powers they possessed? But, sir, by this government, powers are not given to any particular set of men. They're in the hands of the people, delegated to their representatives, chosen for short terms to representatives responsible to the people, and whose situation is perfectly similar to their own. As long as this is the case, we have no danger to apprehend. when the gentleman called our recollection to the usual effects of the concession of powers and imputed the loss of liberty generally to open tyranny, I wish he had gone on farther. Upon his review of history, he would have found that the loss of liberty very often resulted from factions and divisions, from local considerations, which eternally lead to quarrels. He would have found internal dissensions to have more frequently demolished civil liberty than a tenacious disposition in rulers to retain any stipulated powers. Madison is just brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think what he is saying here, and I think we both have said it before, it's he's pointing out that, okay, here's the saying. I'm going to shorten this. If you give government power, don't expect to get it back, right? But what he's pointing out is that the states ceded their power in this very example as the Constitution is being brought about. They're ceding some of their power. So he's kind of smacking that idea down. And then he's going deeper and saying that often the loss of liberty is caused by the result of factions and divisions, which is what's happening in America today. Okay, the powers that be are trying to divide Americans, and that's an observation that just came to mind as I was reading.
Yeah, so one of the big ways that factions actually, you know, create this level of corruption is as soon as, because remember the Teitler cycle of democracy, and the premise is as soon as people realize that they can pull money out of the treasury for their own purposes, for their own good, for their own benefit, then we begin the demise and the corruption of government. This goes back to that early statement of a virtuous people. A virtuous people keeping government within the confines of its enumerated powers will be safely guarded. But it's when people actually say, we want a pork barrel project that benefits us over everybody else, then it gives that local faction, that local group of people, an advantage. And it's usually not for everybody. It's usually for a very specific business, like a defense business, you know, like, you know, building arms, communications, something for the military. Well, that's all shifted now from just this military industrial complex of how they were able to share the spoils. And that's the whole spoil system. When government uses the treasury or the purse of government to actually throw money into local communities, creating jobs and creating wealth, then government is literally violating the Constitution. And so what, and this goes down to the social justice of how people have made this assertion of systemic racism, even though it was never based on race. For the past 200 years, government, through the military industrial complex or what have you, has used the spoil system to benefit very specific areas within America.
Okay.
And so in so doing, they've only corrupted America to where all of a sudden, you know, the life of that weaponry has gone. And now what are we going to do? Well, we have to innovate, or we need another pork barrel project taking us down a different path. And the communities within America. The communities within America are the ones that are seeking the corruption. And so, you know, we actually, they're the ones that are begging. They're the ones driving the corruption. And when Madison's talking about factions, he's talking about these unique communities being divisive over another. No, give us. And so this is where, if we've actually seen this, have you not seen in the past where we have one community winning out a bid to doing something that the government was going to do, and they landed it here instead of there? Do you ever recall any of that?
Oh, sure. Sure, I see that kind of pretty frequently, I think.
Right. So all of a sudden, somehow these people are blessed But you know as well as I do, in the background, there are bribes, there are all sorts of things that determine why that choice was given to that area, those people, they won that contract or what have you.
Okay.
And that is the ultimate of the, this is what they were talking about. That is not a virtuous, that is not a virtuous people. It is where a corrupt people have taken over. Because they're seeking government to give them advantages. Now, here's the question. Were these things done, you know, in the past, for the past 150 years, how many of these things were really done because of racial intent?
When you say the past 150 years, you know...
And I'm talking about using the spoil system of throwing money into communities to be that, you know, is competing for this body of work, competing for this port, competing for the airport or this transshipment point or what have you, for government to make the decision that this is what we're going to go with, this is where we're going to go. How many times has race really been a part of that?
I don't know how to answer this question. I can tell you that race has been affected by government spending in the negative by in which, for example, what Johnson's Great Society, in which they paid mothers to have babies as long as they didn't have fathers in the home. So I'm trying to understand where you're going with this question. Because there certainly has been race-induced government spending.
Yes, so I'll give you a good case in point. The Trail of Tears by Andrew Jackson, by removing the Indians, the Cherokees, out of the South and driving them to Oklahoma, that was clearly a racial exertion of power.
Correct.
Typically, though, there, you know, so we're going to find cases where it happened, but typically, 9 times out of 10, when it comes down to the handing out of money or the handing out of a decision that this port is going to be the port where all of this, you know, stuff, because they can only bring it into one port, right? Or something like that. It's only going to happen at this one point, or this is going to be the company that's going to build our next ships. You know, who's going to, right, you know, build the next ships? Is it going to be in Philadelphia or is it going to be in Portland? And so the whole point that I'm trying to make is that when government starts picking winners and losers, 9 times out of 10, it's not race. Even though it is a faction over another, in other words, the social justice, you know, that's trying to say, hey, you've got to give us these rewards, you know, because it has been done racially unfairly. It really was never done racially unfairly. It was just how the system had been organized. Race really wasn't the consideration. It was just a matter of where those ports were going to be, where they were going to, you know, build this, build that, build these aircrafts, what have you. Where, because that's when government throws money into a community, because what ends up happening when all of a sudden they're going to be building a whole bunch of jets or tanks? Wow, that means that the people that live in that community are going to have a lot of wealth. Or obtain a lot of wealth, because jobs means wealth. And when it comes to government jobs, that's just a pouring in of a lot of money that would never have happened. And so this is how the spoil system was, you know, embellished upon. Look at what Obama did with his green energy. How much of the money that he spent that actually went out to Kaiser, went out to Solyndra, these other companies, how much of that was really done racially? So I'll let you think about this question, you know, as we go into break, because bottom line, we're heading into a break right now. So folks, you know, if you think about this whole point that I'm trying to make, when we go back to this virtuous people and, you know, keeping from corruption, the virtuous is keeping government within its powers. It has nothing to do with race. Race isn't a part of the Constitution. We'll be right back.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so, Paul, I appreciate your patience with me on this, but let me just kind of close on this, because the redistribution of wealth is an evil proposition, and it's an evil game the government plays, and it is an unconstitutional game that our government has no business doing. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so
and they admit doing it.
Go ahead.
And they admit doing it, by the way.
No. But see, when we look over the past few centuries, there hasn't been at least I see no evidence, because if there was evidence, somebody could actually prove this out, that, you know, the awarding of military and other types of decisions where government would throw money in. Because, see, moving forward, government can't use money. If we actually reclaim the republic, government can't use any money for anything other than for its constitutional duties. And the one constitutional duty it has is the militia. In other words, to equip and to fund the training. The states are supposed to do the training, but they're supposed to pay for the equipping and training.
Right. Well, they also can equip a navy.
Well, yes, absolutely. That's the one thing that they're obligated, so that the aircraft for the Navy. The fact that we have a U.S. Air Force, the reason why we have all more and more departments within the Department of Defense, the Department of the Navy, the Department of the Army, the Department of the Air, the only reason that the Department of Air Force and Army have broken up is for political purposes and for spending more money. Because the more duplication you create, the more waste you have, and the more expense you're going to spend. I mean, when companies realize, like HP, when they realized that they were too far spread, that they were wasting too much money because they had too many business units, they did consolidations. And so consolidation is always necessary if you're going to be thrifty, or there's a term, you know, a penny thrift, or anyway, I forget the term, but bottom line, government has to be thrifty. Government has to be conservative in trying to save money. And the fact that they got away with creating the Department of Space is
Space Force.
It's absolutely insane. That should all fall underneath the Department of the Navy.
Sure. And in fact, Trump took great pride in saying that he scribbled his name on a piece of paper, and guess what? Now we have Space Force. He did not have the authority to do that.
No, he didn't. Now, he didn't have the ability or the authority to create the Air Force, or even creating this Department of the Army to be the vestige that it is. And what I mean by that is, when we started fighting foreign wars, our foreign wars were never fought by the army. As a matter of fact, when you look in the 1800s, when we actually went into Cuba and places like that, they didn't send the army. It was the Marine Corps. It was the Navy and the Marine Corps, and our force projection was always done by the Navy because the Navy was our projection of force. And if we have to fight the size of a warfare required, then we have to bolster those forces. And this is where, you know, the militia would then transition into the Navy. You don't stand up a big army. You don't need an army. Right. The Navy can do this. The Navy has the ability to command both aircraft as well as ships in moving people. Why did they do this other than the fact that the more commands they have, the more officers and the more political opportunity for those who play? So this is one of the reasons why I've been, if I was excoriated in the military when I talked about getting rid of the ranks, getting rid of this politics, because it was,
why?
Because it's, you didn't. Officers and other people that felt that, oh no, we needed this because it creates larger structure. It creates a command of more money. It's just an absolute waste. And so when people look at, you know, the guy that's going to dismantle the wasting of money because there's less people that are going to be able to make money. Well, if we have less people that are making money, then they can go off and be productive in society.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
That's right. So anyway,
they can build a business. They can do something that hires people. Okay. Yes. They.
Yes.
There's no loss.
No. So the my whole point is that, you know, we're needing to go down this path of really, I think, cleaning house and getting out of the business of, you know, creating more and more and more government. Every time we turn around that they say we need to do this, it is only benefited, you know, other people in growing government so that they have more political opportunities. That's not government's job. Government's job isn't to create more political opportunities for, you know, commanders and officers and even enlisted. As a matter of fact, you know, we have to look at our military in the most humility that we possibly can, because we just went through a day this past week of celebrating, or not actually celebrating, but commemorating and recognizing the loss of life that comes from fighting for liberty. So to think that this is a great thing that we want to celebrate and aggrandize, but having an effective and capable military is essential, but having a larger force of politicians is not essential. And so anyway, you got to challenge the paradigms. We actually have to go down that path of saying, you know, how does this make sense? So,
correct.
All right. All things being said, let's get back to what Madison basically stated, because we've got about less than 20 minutes left, and there's quite a bit that we need to cover on June 6th here. And so have we covered various means whereby nations lost their liberties? I think that's what we were going to lead into.
That evoked this conversation.
Okay. All right.
And now we're in jurisdiction.
Okay. Right? All right. There we go. And so this is actually going to transcend from jurisdiction into amendments, into enumerated, because this is a long, multicolored section. And then we jump down with a little skip over for money and another note. And then we get into, then we'll, you know, hopefully by this point in time, we'll probably have covered it. So I'll keep close watch at the time. Go ahead and get started with jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction. I confess to you, sir, where uniformity of religion. I confess to you, sir, were uniformity of religion to be introduced by this system, it would, in any opinion, be ineligible. But I have no reason to conclude that uniformity of government will produce that of religion. This subject is, for the honor of America, perfectly free and unshackled The government has no jurisdiction over it. The least reflection will convince us there is no danger to be feared on this ground. Now, I missed who was objecting to this, but I think he managed to answer it quite well. Okay.
So actually, if you look ahead, so Governor Randolph kind of started off the day. So you have to look, because he ended up on the other, you know, as the last commentator. The person that spoke, mm-hmm. the anti-federalist that spoke before Madison and Randolph, was Henry. So in other words, if you just look up the little, you know, the navigation pane, and you can see, well, who was that last anti-federalist that was spoke? That was Henry. That was the previous day. Okay. So go ahead.
I see. Mr. Henry, yeah, spoke the previous day. So Madison was referring to this. Okay. So Virginia was one of these debates that had both the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists
yep.
views openly shared. Okay. So now I'm on amendments and state structure.
Yep.
But we are flattered with the probability of obtaining previous amendments. This calls for the most serious attention of this House. If amendments are to be proposed by one state, other states have the same right and will also propose alterations. These cannot but be dissimilar and opposite in their nature. I beg leave to remark that the governments of the different states are in many respects dissimilar in their structure. Their legislative bodies are not similar. Their executive are more different.
Can I pause you?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so what he's talking about, that we're talking about here, is that these legislatures were not bicameral. But okay. Today they are. So what happened? This goes back to how I proved that this Constitution, it literally changed how states govern themselves. And this goes back to my assertion that even though they did the best they could, they didn't understand it well enough to do it right. Because when they talk about the amendment process, they felt that just a democracy would be sufficient. Why was it important that we had a 3/4 rule instead of a democracy for the U.S. Constitution?
Oh,
because it was about checks and balances. And so when people actually went into, you know, forming their new state constitutions and forming their new state government, they didn't bake these same types of checks and balances. Why wouldn't they? Did they think that they wouldn't need it? Well, look today, as government has only grown, you know, unvarnished. I mean, it is just going and blooming everywhere. It's boom, 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 boom. There's no control over government anymore because we don't have these checks and balances. And now it begs, why didn't they do this? And I'm telling you, it had more to do with the lack of understanding that these few men had. And what these few men didn't do is they didn't write down, you know, and describe this new form of republicanism and why bicameral legislation was actually these checks and why to keep these majority. I mean, had they written down, you know, this guide of how to form a better state, I think we would have been better served. Mm-hmm. But they didn't do that. Why? Why didn't they do that?
They did leave us the ratification dates, right?
Well, I submit that they didn't do it because they were men that believed that you had to learn by your own mistakes. That we had to prove that, you know, without checks and balances, states could go sideways. And that's been proven. And it's been proven more so ever since the changing of the county structure in representation. And so now's the time to start fixing these things. But I'm sorry, keep going. Go ahead.
Let's see. I beg leave to remark that the governments of the different states are in many respects dissimilar. I just read that.
Uh-huh.
The dissimilarity has occasioned a diversity of opinion on the theory of government, which will, without many reciprocal concessions, render a concurrence impossible. Although the appointment of an executive magistrate has not been thought destructive to the principles of democracy in many of the states. Why did he say that? Yet, in the course of the debate, we find objections made to the federal executive. It is urged that the president will degenerate into a tyrant. I intended, in compliance with the call of the honorable member, to explain the reasons of proposing this constitution and develop its principles, but I shall postpone my remarks till we hear the supplement which he has informed us he intends to add to what he has already said. He uses the term democracy here.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Right.
I'm going to read this again because I want to make sure I understand it, and maybe you can explain why he used it. Although the appointment of an executive magistrate has not been thought destructive to the principles of democracy in many of the states, yet in the course of the debate, we find objections made to the federal executive. So how does Madison get away with using the term democracy in this sense?
So he's talking about a, you know, in choosing the executive, it is done by the voice of the people, by the people voting. Now, in the federal, see, they talk about, they're complaining about this federal, you know, magistrate or the executive, actually, not a magistrate, because yeah. There's definitely a difference.
Right, okay.
But this executive is being chosen by the people. By the people's electors. Again, it's not a direct democracy, but you know, he doesn't get in and he doesn't differentiate direct democracy or what have you. For the intents and purposes, at the state level, they were choosing their, and I don't know if they even had an electoral college in any of the states for choosing their executives, whether it was literally, because you got to remember that even in their democracy, they didn't have a true democracy. The only people that could vote were those people who could pay the poll taxes. Why? Because the poll taxes was one of the mechanisms of funding government. So even in what they called a form of democracy, you had to pay to actually engage in that democracy. You just didn't have this right to go and, you know, give me a ballot and I'm voting. You actually had to pay to get that ballot.
And you had to have the means to pay.
Right. So the words that they use, they're talking literally in more of a general sense than this, you know, that they actually had a real form of democracy where a one person, one vote type of thing. They're only talking about when he's using this democracy in this form, he's talking about the choice of the people that are voting. Not the
okay.
not a true pure democracy. Right.
Okay. You use the term principles of democracy. All right. But as you say, they were choosing their executive magistrates, or I'm guessing their governors, by popular vote in the states.
And I believe that those people who paid to vote got to choose their governor. Yes.
Right. And in fact, I think the Electoral College was a construction of this constitution.
Yes.
Brilliant, though, by the way. So I think it was just, I think it was so novel and new and understandable why they set this up this way. Their brilliance continues to amaze me. I guess the next one is enumerated jurisdiction and confederation.
Confederalism. Instead, you hear the term federalism. Federalism
right.
is regarding a general government having general powers. Confederalism is limited powers. So there you go.
Okay. All right. Enumerated jurisdiction, confederalism. Give me here to say something of the nature of the government and to show that it is safe and just to vest it with the power of taxation. There are a number of opinions, but the principal question is whether to be a federal or consolidated government. In order to judge properly of the question before us, we must consider it minutely in its principal parts. I conceive myself that it is of a mixed nature. It is, in a manner, unprecedented. We cannot find one express example in the experience of the world. It stands by itself. In some respects, it is a government of a federal nature. In others, it is of a consolidated nature. even if we attend to the manner in which the Constitution is investigated, ratified, and made the act of the people of America, I can say, notwithstanding what the honorable gentleman has alleged, that this government is not completely consolidated, nor is it entirely federal. Who are the parties to it? The people, but not the people as composing one great body, but the people as composing 13 sovereignties. Were it, as the gentleman asserts, a consolidated government, the assent of a majority of the people would be sufficient for its establishment. And as a majority have adopted it already, the remaining states would be bound by the act of the majority, even if they unanimously reprobated it. Were it such a government as is suggested, it would be now binding on the people of this state without having the privilege of deliberating upon it. But, sir, no state is bound by it, as it is, without its own consent. Should all the states adopt it, it will be then a government established by the 13 states of America, not through the intervention of legislatures, but by the people at large. Now, I think here he's describing the ratifying conventions of each of the states.
Yes,
and not the
yes, correct? He is. But he's making a very clear point that it is this: the Constitution is not really being ratified by the people at the national level, nor is it even being ratified by the people at the state level. It is still being done in a Republican form, that representatives are actually ratifying the Constitution state by state.
Correct.
Not the state legislatures, but representatives of the people. Okay, there you go.
even though legislatures are representatives of the people, they wanted to make this separate.
Uh-huh. And they knew that because they knew that the state legislators, you know, would possibly not be invited to the dance, that this would, by basically having a convention of the people, then the state legislatures would, you know, be at risk of not actually being involved in the convention itself. Right. That's what happened, too.
Okay. In this particular respect, the distinction between the existing and proposed governments is very material. The existing system had been derived from the dependent derivative authority of the legislatures of the states, whereas this is derived from the superior power of the people. If we look at the manner in which alterations are to be made in it, the same idea is in some degree attended to. By the new system, a majority of the states cannot introduce amendments, nor are all the states required for that purpose. 3/4 of them must concur in alterations. In this, there is a departure from the federal idea. The members to the National House of Representatives are to be chosen by the people of large in proportion to the number of the respective districts. When we come to the Senate, its members are elected by the states in their equal and political capacity. But had the government been completely consolidated, Senate would have been chosen by the people in their individual capacity in the same manner as the members of the other house. Thus, it is of a complicated nature, and this complication, I trust, will be found to exclude the evils of absolute consolidation as well as a mere confederacy. If Virginia was separated from all the states, her power and authority would be a consolidated government. But the powers of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited subjects beyond which it cannot extend beyond its jurisdiction.
There you go. And so jump down, and I think we've got enough time to cover the money, the first highlighted yellow part.
Okay.
Because we got four minutes right now.
Ooh, I'll try to read fast. Okay. When, therefore, direct taxes are not necessary, they will not be recurred to. It can be of little advantage to those in power to raise money in a manner oppressive to the people. To consult the conveniences of the people will cost them nothing, and in many respects will be advantageous to them. Direct taxes will only be recurred to for great purposes. What has brought on other nations those immense debts under the pressure of which many of them labor? Not the expenses of their governments, but war. If this country should be engaged in war, I can see if we ought to provide for the possibility of such a case, how would it be carried on? By the usual means provided from year to year? As our imports will be necessary for the expenses of government and other common exigencies, how are we to carry on the means of defense? How is it possible a war could be supported without money or credit? And would it be possible for a government to have credit without having the power of raising money? No, it would be impossible for any government in such a case to defend itself. Then I say, sir, that it is necessary to establish funds for extraordinary exigencies and to give this power to the general government for the utter inutility of previous requisitions on the states is too well known. Would it be possible for those countries whose finances and revenues are carried to the highest perfection to carry on the operations of government on great emergencies, such as the maintenance of a war, without an uncontrolled power of raising money? Has it not been necessary for Great Britain, notwithstanding the facility of the collection of taxes, to have recourse very often to this and other extraordinary methods of procuring money? Would not her public credit have been ruined if it was known that her power to raise money was limited? Has not France been obliged on great occasions to use unusual means to raise funds? It has been the case in many countries, and no government can exist unless its powers extend to make provisions for every contingency. If we were actually attacked by a powerful nation and our general government had not the power of raising money, but depended solely on requisitions, our condition would be truly deplorable. If the revenue of this commonwealth were to depend on 20 distinct authorities, it would be impossible for it to carry on its operations. This must be obvious to every member here, I think. Therefore, that it is necessary for the preservation of the union that this power shall be given to the general government.
Now, they say this a lot, and they go through this all the time, over and over and over, about the importance of direct taxation and the ability for the government to be able to function its necessary functions, to be able to defend and protect the sovereignty. Folks, our government's responsibility, it's foremost, the federal government's foremost responsibility is to protect the sovereignty of the states. And yet somehow our federal government has turned the corner on us and is actually selling us out to, you know, those who are willing to come and line their pockets with gold. This is without any doubt. We're living in a time where our own government has been waging warfare against us, our liberties, and our law. It is that simple. Right. So 15 seconds. Thank you so much, Paul, for coming on. I, you know, don't get a chance to do this because too many times we're just in a hurry. We look forward to having you on next week to continuing, because the Virginia ratification debates are that intense. So, folks,
I'm looking forward. Thanks again.
You bet. No problem. So, folks, we are out for the day, and tomorrow is Feedback Friday. So, all I can say is be ready and come. If you've got any feedback, get it to me. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.